This week on Out Now with Aaron and Abe, we're talking 28 years later, : the Bone Temple.
Aaron, do you think Ralph Fiennes has a bone to pick with us?
Wait a minute, I forgot my introduction.
We are now recording, and this is Out Now with Aaron and Abe. I am Aaron, and as always, this is...
Abe, hello! Aaron, you sound not great.
I am not the best. No, I've been under the weather throughout the weekend here, but I shall move forward, I guess.
The only way out is through. Did you get yourself some chicken noodle soup?
Too much salt. I had lentil soup.
Too much salt. Okay, all right.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully you're feeling better soon.
It's helping. So we'll see. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for asking.
Well, Out Now is a film podcast where Abe and I discuss new movies weekly. We dig into film through mostly spoiler-free reviews, the occasional commentary track, or some other film movie topic. This is episode 651. 651.
651? I feel like that's in California somewhere. Just kidding. It's in Minnesota.
The California of the Middle East.
Yeah.
Note for the show, it's actually 652. Carry on.
And Stay safe out there, everybody in Minnesota.
Yeah.
Indeed.
And joining us for...
What's happening over there?
Right.
Is it cold?
It's icy.
That's a good one. Off the top, too.
Yeah, good job.
Before episode 651, we're talking 28 years later, The Bone Temple. Follow-up to last year's 28 years later. And joining us to discuss the Bone Temple, we have our East Coast survivor willing to go maybe one round on the ring with Samson. It's Alan Aguilera.
Oh, hey guys. How are we doing? Big dogs in the house.
Oh. You can take Samson. You can take Samson.
Also joining us from Cal State Fullerton, he's all for a round of charity. It's Professor Mike Dillon.
Hello.
Charity. No shirts, charity.
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 How are you both doing this evening?
Under the weather like you.
I
got whatever you got.
I feel fine.
You guys in the same room? Hopefully not.
Hopefully not.
I'm pretty good.
Well, good. I'm glad to have you both here. Alan, it has been a minute, but always glad to have you on this show. Look forward to hearing what you have to say about the film later, as well as you, Mike. Looking forward to hearing your thoughts. And let's go over some show notes. First up, commentary tracks. We do them every month, and this month we started our new theme of commentaries for the next couple months, which is our Teenage Wasteland series, and we began with American Graffiti, George Lucas's 1973 coming-of-age hit. We put that together, got that up the other. Somehow I gathered the strength that I was feeling my worst, put that commentary out. That's up now. It's a lot of fun, and I think quite informative, so check that out when you can. What else? Specials. We have specials coming. We did our top 10 episode last week, which is a lot of fun and packed. And Abe, great job editing it together. I think it turned out really, really well.
Thank you. I liked your note about, is this going to sound effect going to be in the entire thing? The answer is yes.
But no, it was a fun episode to kind of listen back to once you get the whole picture up there. But we still have more to come. We have our horror awards, which Mike, you're always involved with. And we will, that'll be coming soon enough. And, of course, we'll have our Oscar show in a couple months from now because, Jesus, the Oscars take forever to get here. But we still have, some fun shows to keep going over some 2025 films. So stay tuned for all that bonus material. And, if you like all that stuff we're doing, if you like all that we're putting out there, feel free to go on to iTunes or Spotify or anywhere you can rate these shows and give us a rating or review, which would be great.
Thank you so much in advance.
Yeah. All right. Let's get to some bad cookies.
Trademark.
Each one I know when we do to talk about the week that other week is
TM. Thank you, Alan.
Thank you, Alan. Alan, I'm going to start with you. What have you seen recently?
What did I say? Well, I just went to DC for the holidays, so I watched National Treasure 1 and 2.
Oh,
to prepare.
And I was like, hey,
yeah, planning on stealing the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, it's funny because we split the trip between Philly and DC. So National Treasure was perfect because they went to Philly and DC. So it's like, that's cool. And then catching up on The Pit. A lot of, random TV stuff, but I've just been trying to play video games and catch up on old movies. I'm trying to think what else we watched. I watched all the Lord of the Rings. Because I just do around this time of year.
Extended editions?
Of course, man. Here's the other thing I also did. I watched all the Hobbit movies extended edition too.
Wow,
I did that.
That's during... a lot of movie.
Yeah, I so you that. Watched like 24 hours of straight movies, huh?
I did that during COVID, and I was like, oh yeah, these are movies.
Yeah, yeah, and then I just went through some Shutter stuff. I can pull up my Letterboxd right now, but no, I watched Where Evil Lurks Again, or When Evil Lurks Again.
Oh, I love that movie. Brutal.
I watched 28 Days Later, the original again. I watched 28 Days Later, years later, and weeks. I watched all three. I watched If I Had Legs, I Could Kick You.
Mm.
And Rosemary was great. I didn't really care for the movie, though, but she was great. Oh, I watched Hamnet, too, and I didn't really – it was fine.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, so that's
a lot of movies.
Sounds like you got a lot done.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is like the last we're talking about since I was last on the show in February, right?
That's what we try to do. Try to make sure our guests recap the whole year.
Right, yeah.
No, that's just what I watched like the last few weeks. I'm just trying to think. But yeah.
Perfect.
My favorite part of National Treasure, the first one, is Nick Cage and Sean Bean and all of them are like trying to find something, and they're walking through some snow, and they have whatever guide they're using, and they're like, here, it's here. And he like digs like maybe less than a foot into the snow, and it's like, there it is. They find the entire fucking ship that they're looking for. It's like, well, that was pretty simple. It took no effort at all.
Nobody's ever tried this hard. They've only
ever tried to dig this little bit of snow out of the way.
And there was digging. That's like a lot of effort.
I said less than a foot. He took like three scoops. He's like, yep, got it.
Three scoops. That's more than the Raisin Bran.
It's like, oh, that's what kind of movie we're in. That's what I enjoy about that.
It's a climate change commentary.
Yeah, bang. Sure. There you go.
All right. Well, Mike, what have you been watching recently?
Honestly, not much. I've been overseas for a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
I just saw The Rip on Netflix.
Uh-huh.
Which is pretty solid.
I watched it too, and I would agree with you.
Yeah, I mean, Joe Carnahan's got a north of a decent track record, I think.
Not a fan.
I wish Netflix would put out more like this, frankly. Mm-hmm. I'd say it's about 15 minutes too long. I think you feel it most in the third act.
Yes.
But great premise, good kind of twisty turny script. Damon and Affleck have, perhaps not surprisingly, really good screen chemistry. So that's a fun time.
Cool.
I've been watching a lot of Shudder films that are coming out across the next couple months. None are particularly noteworthy, except I want to mention one. Full disclosure, it's made by friends of mine, but it's called Body Cam. I think it comes out March 9th. Brandon Christensen's the director, and he's a pretty, if you don't know him, he's a pretty prolific horror director at like the streaming level. He just put out something last year called Night of the Reaper. And then it's produced by Kurt Harder, who directed the Influencer films.
Okay.
Who I just had in my class a month ago. So Body Cam is kind of a found footage horror film about a couple of patrol officers, and the whole thing is shot from their body cams. Mm. And they're responding to a welfare check in kind of a bad neighborhood, and they stumble upon a satanic cult.
Yeah,
Hell yeah.
Yeah, it's all done through their body cams. It's pretty nicely done.
I'm in.
Yeah, it's fun. I believe March 9th is the drop date, so look out for that. But otherwise, the one film I've seen that I really am enthusiastic about is called Pillion.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, with Alexander Skarsgård and Harry Melling. I don't want to say much about it because I didn't know anything going into it and would prefer people have the same experience, but it's like a gay BDSM-themed romantic dark comedy.
Mm-hmm.
It's really funny, and also just it's very pure and never judgmental of the characters. It's a really fun time, and I would have top 10 this if I'd caught it before year's end, but it's the first really great film I've seen so far this year.
We do allow amendments.
Who's we?
I changed mine once.
I'm not going to re-record, but put an asterisk next to mine.
There you go. Yeah, asterisks.
All right. Well, Abe, how about you?
That is it.
I have been watching largely nothing but professional sports in the past weekend. It is playoff time for the NFL. So yesterday I watched my team get mollywopped 41-6 to the Seattle Seahawks. The 49ers lost in tremendously dramatic, sad fashion. The vibes were not good. It was probably the worst game of the weekend for all the playoff games.
Embarrassing.
it, truly embarrassing. And I know that you're saying that in a way to possibly hopefully, you know, bring me up. But no, it really was embarrassing. Two field goals. The kickoff return was awful. But every other game this weekend actually has been quite competitive and interesting. But that 49ers game, maybe there's some truth to that conspiracy theory that the electromagnetic discharge of a nearby energy power plant of the football stadium is causing all of our soft tissue issues on the field. But in large part, it's just been a lot of basketball or football and basketball.
If that was the case, they wouldn't have made it to the playoffs.
He's got you there.
Did we get lucky versus the Philadelphia Eagles? I'm not sure. But yes, I hear what you're saying.
The Philadelphia Eagles had a shitty, shitty year. They weren't going to win. This isn't a Super Bowl run year for them.
No, they were not.
Yeah. E-A-G-L-E-S Eagles?
Hannah Einbinder's favorite.
Oh, yeah, that sounds like a pretty horrific game. Meanwhile,
I spent 3 days in Philly. I'm a Philly fan now. I don't know what to tell you.
I watched that Bears Rams game. That was exciting.
Bears Rams game. Yeah, a touchdown in the last 40 seconds. It's crazy to go down overtime. So yeah, I mean, even the Broncos game yesterday was amazing too. So in any case, that's all I've been watching.
Okay, I got the text from Abe saying, "Stop talking about sports. You know how I feel about that." So I'll stop chiming in with my opinions on the sports games.
We'll send that screenshot out to the show, to the Instagram.
I've seen a few things. I did watch the rip, like Mike, I mentioned when Mike talked about it. And mm-hmm. I agree with part of what you said. Since we didn't have an episode last week, as far as doing over new releases, I saw Primate. Mike, did you see Primate?
I've seen Primate.
Did you see that at Beyonce's?
It's fun. No, I saw it. I got a screener. This was like December. Okay.
Yeah. All right. Regardless, I saw Primate. I enjoyed it. It's from Johannes Roberts, who he did the 47 Meters Down movies, but he also did that Strangers sequel, Pray at Night, the one that's not the terrible Rennie Harlan movies.
Yeah.
And that sequel I quite enjoyed because of how stylish it was. And that's what I thought this movie had a lot going for it. It felt very colorful, and there's the same composer, so it had this really cool score. I'm not going to say it's amazing, but in terms of when animals attack movies go, like, I was satisfied with what they gave me, so it worked out.
That's interesting, because I liked it for the same reasons as far as a B creature feature goes. It could do much worse, but I came away thinking way too much pool.
You got too much pool.
So this entire sequence based around a swimming pool, and I was like, we're spending way too much time in this pool. And then I'm just learning that he did Strangers Pray at Night. Didn't that have a really good pool?
It has one of the best slasher scenes involving a pool of all time. Yes.
Yeah. All right. Pretty great.
I don't know what to make of that, but
he loves pools.
For one thing, there's less pool in that movie, but I would also say not as much pool as I thought there would be in this movie, honestly. I thought there was going to be like Cujo, where they're just like in that car the whole time. Like, they're going to just be in that pool the whole time. Like, they're like, no, I don't disagree. There could be less pool. But
what was that magic pool movie where, you know, the waters were killing Kurt Russell's son?
Wyatt Russell. Night Swim.
Night Swim. Yeah. Okay. Never mind.
That's a movie.
Doesn't have any pool name in it.
Just
as January releases go, you could do worse than Primate.
I think Primate's in the upper tier of like throwaway horror releases for January for sure. I also saw Greenland 2: Migration.
Colon migration? Are you sure you're feeling all right?
We don't need to get overly personal on this podcast. That's for the night's episodes.
X-Lax. That's who our sponsor is.
Greenland, the first one, came out in 2020 during COVID, and it was a curiosity that worked out better than I had expected. I was like, oh, this is a pretty solid disaster movie with Gerard Butler playing just like a blue collar guy. Like, I liked what it was doing. Mm-hmm. So I was curious about Greenland too, because you don't often get like a sequel to a disaster movie. And when you do, they're generally quite bad. So I'm like, well, what could this amount to? But I'm not going to say Greenland 2 is amazing, but I do think it works about as well as it needs to for a sequel to that movie, as far as finding new ways to show a level of devastation or what have you and race against time type antics while Butler and Marina Baccarin and Jojo Rabbit, who's now like 5 feet tall, 6 feet tall.
5 feet tall.
He played. Yeah, he's like, he's not that tall. No, he's like 6 feet tall. He's super tall now. Yeah. He plays.
Well, I'm
plays
glad because last time we saw him, he got killed in the Long Walk.
He got killed in the Long Walk. And I was like, because even in the Long Walk, he doesn't look the same. It's like, this kid's growing. he's still growing. But it's fine. Like it's a little weird to watch a movie about Greenland now, but
right.
As Alan asked earlier, why? What's happening?
Yeah, preparing for the third film, right? Greenland : Hostile Takeover.
Exactly.
It's just a really good PR campaign, guys. Come on,
it's a really good PR campaign.
But no, as far as disaster movies go, these Greenland movies aren't bad. They do the job.
Okay.
I also watched I'm Chevy Chase and You're Not.
Mm-hmm. Heard this a lot about this.
A documentary covering Chevy Chase's kind of life and career. And it's fine. I will say, I don't think it ever gets any spicier than just like the trailer for the documentary goes when he just like just out and out acts like the asshole that most people assume Chevy Chase is. Mm-hmm. The doc doesn't really do a lot to dispel the idea that he can be an unsavory character, nor does it provide too much to like have you understand why. It provides some hints about like his childhood and whatnot, and things that you would kind of expect to be the reason as to why somebody would behave the way they do, yet also still be talented and what have you. So like, it's more or less just like 2 hours of, hey, you, if you want to see the the highs and lows of Chevy Chase, here it is. It's pretty, I don't want to say unfiltered, but it's pretty candid. It doesn't really shy away from the, you know, the things that he and his family probably wouldn't necessarily want everybody else to see. That said, I mean, for all, you know, the bad that comes of Chevy Chase's kind of, I don't know, legacy, has a stable marriage, he has kids, he has people that do like working with him. So, I mean, there's more than just the, you know, the persona that many people do not like. So, but I wish yeah, the doc had kids
that like him and still talk to him.
Yeah,
I think that's pretty major with a lot of these.
I would agree. Yeah,
older guys. Yeah,
I'd very much agree about that. I mean, that's you know,
that says something.
It does. It like, yeah. That's why, like, when I look at like Beverly D'Angelo in the Vacation movies, like, she seems to be fine with him. Like, you know, so like whatever, you know, I can't speak to everything that goes on with Chevy, but there's a part of him that works for some people that just doesn't work for other people for whatever reason.
Noted.
Does it take away the idea that, you know, sometimes you're just, you know, at the bad end of the, you know, the bad end of things and is the problem. But I just wish the doc did more to kind of assess that action as opposed to just presenting stuff to us.
But can't wait for your doc on him then, Aaron.
One last thing I watched, I won't do too much about it, but I watched The Wolf of Wall Street again just because I wanted to have something on in the background while I was slowly dying in bed last night. And I noticed something. Whenever Leonardo DiCaprio has kids in a movie, it's not good for the kids. If you ever noticed, when he's a father, there's always something bad that's going to happen to the children.
Yeah, I guess.
They die. There's spousal abuse. They die again. They're kidnapped. There's never like Leonardo DiCaprio's a dad and everything's just fine for the kids.
I mean, I guess, yeah, it's happy ending of sorts for one bad author or another. But I hear what you're saying. Yeah,
she
goes through a whole ordeal.
There's always some kind of jeopardy that they're at the very least. This is something I noticed. Like, there's never like Annie had kids. Like, there's nothing that it's always something.
Well, what about Inception? He's kind of...
They done. I mean, he's like stranded from them the whole movie.
And also, like,
right, but we don't see them in peril.
But in terms of like just him being a father, it's not easy. Like, he has there's some kind of...
He's an absent father. Yeah.
There's some. He's an absent father for one thing. He's trapped in dream world.
Their mom died.
Yeah, also, exactly. Yes, exactly. Their mom committed suicide.
Their two kids
forgot about that.
Yeah. It's just something because I looked through his filmography, I'm like, huh, there's no good version of Daddy DiCaprio over here.
Yeah, not great.
So yeah,
that was your takeaway from watching The Wolf of Wall Street.
When your mind's spinning and you don't have a lot to think about beyond how can I get to sleep and not feel pain anymore? Yeah, that's where my head was at. I'm like, huh, where are the DiCaprio films where he's a dad?
Whip out your IMDb of Leo.
Yeah, even like Don't Look Up. It's like, well, the world blows up. So let me know.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Like again, The Revenant. His son dies. I think Revolutionary Road. You know, is it even his kid? I don't know.
Yeah, it's just problem, problem, problem.
Yeah. Well,
like, one day we'll write kids with Eating Gilbert. Great.
Yeah, well, yeah. Just wait for that sequel.
Got some problems there too.
Yeah. All right. That's out of quickies.
Trademark.
Let's move on to some trailer talk. We talk about the newest movie show there was the week when we thought of it. It's coming out. What have you? This week we have Lee Cronin's The Mummy.
Thank you for the full title.
I mean, they're advertising it that way, so we got to make sure
they are.
This is, of course, the newest Mummy film that's both a Blumhouse production and an Atomic Monster production, as in both James Wan and Jason Blum are involved in this one. It's directed by Lee Cronin, who made Evil Dead Rise a couple years ago. It stars Jack Rayner, among others. I'm going to read the brief plot synopsis that they have on here. The young daughter of a journalist disappears without a trace in the desert. The shattered family is stunned when the girl suddenly reappears 8 years later, but what should have been a joyful family reunion quickly turns into a true and horrifying nightmare. Alan, I'll ask you, what do you think of this trailer for the Mummy?
Well, that plot synopsis gives me more context into the trailer I want. I went in blind. I didn't know anything about it. Mm. I was like, oh, that looks cool. I don't really know what's going on. But, you know, I really loved Evil Dead Rise, so I'm going to give it a shot. I hope it's good. But I don't really see anything that's making me super excited, only because I didn't. You say The Mummy. I'm like, cool. I just didn't pick up on the context that it was all of that. But that's exciting. If the little girl's a mummy, I'm down. Or if something happens.
I'll note that Mike has recused himself from trailers. He didn't tend to watch trailers very much. But Abe, what do you think? What do you think of this Mummy trailer?
Looks interesting. It had some couple moves that I was like, okay, well, I see the vibe that we're going for here, or the overall effect of, that is a little bit much more on the intense side of storytelling and perhaps about body horror. But I am largely unsure of this. Maybe I'll watch the next trailer after it comes out as well, because I think this is just like the teaser trailer, right?
Yeah.
So perhaps I'll break my own rule for this one to check out the next one. But I agree with Alan from what you said about it, more than what I knew before going into seeing the trailer, even after seeing the trailer. So we'll see what happens.
I'll just note that the Mummy movies we've gotten in recent decades obviously have been adventure films, you know, not really horror films necessarily. Sure. So I like that this wants to be a horror movie Mummy. I just frankly haven't seen that in a long time. We got the Brendan Fraser trilogy and we have Cruise Mummy, of course. I haven't seen like a Mummy movie that like very much intentionally wanted to be a horror film in a long time. So you got a guy that I know for making horror films with producers that make horror films, making a horror version of The Mummy. That's at least something new. You know, it's not just trotting up the, you know, the same old when it comes to doing a Mummy movie again. So that has me intrigued, at least compared to just doing like another cheaper version of Adventure Mummy, given that it's like a Blumhouse production. So, it'll, you know, take place in.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, also Brendan Fraser is going to cover that when he does his.
Yeah, so they say they're all coming back to make a fourth Mummy.
And can't wait for all the brown face.
Yeah. I'm just. Right.
I would love to see more brown faces in my media.
This is true. This is absolutely correct.
Mike, anything to add? Or I know you've recused yourself from the trailer, but you're good. Yeah, I figured so. Lee Cronin's The Mummy arrives in theaters on April 17th, 2026. So we shall see.
Okay, good for them.
Yeah.
Also note that it's Warner Brothers as opposed to Universal, given that it's the WB in the classic Universal Monsters realm. Since it's what's it called?
I don't know where you're going here.
Where the property is like just up for grabs.
Loose IP for sale.
Basically, yeah. Public domain. Yeah.
When is this coming out again, Aaron?
Sorry?
What's the release date?
April 17th.
Yeah.
Oh, so way too early for spooky season.
For one thing, it's never too early for Super Geek season.
Absolutely correct. But, you know, we can't include in our spooktacular savings events.
Sure. We won't be able to do that. Yeah, that's, you're not wrong. All right, let's move on. Let's get to our main review for 28 Years Later, : The Bone Temple.
This is a memorial to the dead.
So, is this all you're doing?
It is.
Are you Old Nick?
Old Nick? You mean Satan?
Yes. Old Nick released his demons unto the world of man. And the world of man fell before the demons.
I remember details, events and people. The world had an order.
What's your name?
Spike.
No, I think your name is Jimmy.
The foundations. They seemed unshakable.
That should have been some of the trailer for 28 Years Later, The Bone Temple. Last summer, after years of being asked whether or not we'd ever get another entry in the 28 Blank Later series, Danny Boyle and Alex Garland delivered the first part of a supposed trilogy. 28 Years Later pushed us into a future version of the rage-infected British Isle established back in 2003. We largely followed Spike, a 12-year-old who began the film having his zombie bar mitzvah with his dad, only to strike back out onto the mainland with his sick mother in search of help from one Dr. Kelson. By the end of that film, Kelson euthanized Spike's mother and went about his ways while Spike decided to look out for himself, only to be taken in by an athletic cult. The Bone Temple picks up right where we left off, as the cult's leader, Jimmy Crystal, forces Spike to kill one of their members so he can join up with them. Meanwhile, Dr. Kelson curiously learns that one of the ways he keeps back Samson, an aggressive alpha zombie, may actually be a window into finding some sort of remedy for the virus. Eventually, the paths of the Jimmys and Kelson collide, but there's more going on than just this. Alan,
yeah,
I want to know, much like Abe, your number one film of last year was 28 Years Later.
Hell yeah.
So now we have this film, The Bone Temple, which is it screened fairly early and I already had rave reviews, many people claiming it even better than the 28 Years Later. I want to know, what did you think of 28 Years Later, The Bone Temple?
Well, 28 Years Later made me cry. The Bone Temple did not. But I did lean over to my girlfriend while we watched this movie and I said, this is the greatest movie of all time.
Wow.
It was during, I don't know, how many spoilers are we doing for this?
We can hold off on spoilers, yeah. But yeah.
Okay. So we'll get back to that later. I thought this movie was rad. I think there's less Spike in it than I would like, but I love the focus on Kelson. Jack O'Connell is a charisma machine. I can watch him all day. And there's a moment when he and Kelson have a scene, and I thought that was one of the best scenes I've seen in a long time, just the two characters having a conversation. I really enjoyed it. I just think this movie was really, really well done. I love the ending. I kind of liked everything about it. My only real beef with it is it wasn't as, I guess, divisive as 28 Years Later, with all the different tricks that Danny Boyle put in with the iPhone, intercutting with classic medieval English iconography. With this one, there's less than that. It's more of a straightforward movie, which I hope more people go to see, because it's not doing great in the box office this weekend. But I really enjoyed it. I really had a good time with it. I think it's a worthy sequel to 28 Years Later. Don't love it quite as much as that, but I love it for different reasons, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to go see it in 4DX today,
mm-hmm.
because I was going to come and start a new 4DX report. Mm-hmm. Because my girlfriend will go see anything that's in 4DX, so we will go. So we were going to go today. We were ready. Mm-hmm. We were dressed. We were on our way to the theater. And then I looked at my email, and it said, hey, here's your refund for 4DX.
Oh.
And I said, why? So, I was like, okay, let me figure it out. So I went online, and I looked at what the showings were. They canceled the Bone Temple 4DX for an Avatar screening. Mm. That was sold out.
Boo.
So I am, you know, I'm pissed because that's probably the last chance I'm going to get to see the Bone Temple in 4DX, because I really wanted to go through some of those scenes in 4DX and get the shit kicked out of me.
There's one in particular I imagine would be pretty cool.
Oh, yeah, dude, that's all I wanted. I was like, this is it. This is going to be your first rock concert in 4DX. But Didn't get a chance to. That was a bum because I was really excited to see it again and twice. But I think that was also indicative of how little that movie is doing well in the box office. It was just blowing my mind. And also, they didn't send me that email till like an hour before the show. So how did that Avatar screening sell out so quickly in 4DX?
Hmm.
Unless they canceled it a few, I don't know. I didn't think about it, but anyway, I have a beef with Rego right now in Ballantyne. You're on my shit list, boys.
Well, in the future, we're looking forward to more Alan 4DX reports that will chime That's in every now and then. That is something that we look forward to in the future.
I can like lie, like most journalists do now, but I don't want to do that.
Alan GPT?
ChatGPT. No, I'm like, I'm not going to be Brian Williams reporting from a helicopter crash I didn't participate in. But from now on, when I go see 4DX, I will always give a report to Out Now and Aaron and Abe.
Which we'll appreciate that.
I am the East Coast correspondent of 4DX experiences.
Our reach grows wider every day.
Mm-hmm.
Mike, you were a bit cooler on 28 Years Later in the same way that I was, as far as I don't think neither of us disliked the film, but I think we certainly saw that there was perhaps potential for more, or maybe something that a sequel could perhaps fulfill that the initial entry didn't quite reach. How do you feel about the Bone Temple?
Yeah, I think we liked it, but we wanted to love it and didn't. Mm-hmm. Is that fair?
Yeah,
I'd say that. Yeah, I felt, trying to recall the conversation we had when we recorded on that one. I think the gist of it was that it was a bit all over the place. Like they were throwing out too many new ideas to like reacquaint us with the rules of this world, and also taking some pretty big swings stylistically. And the result was, in my opinion, a bit muddled. That's, I think, important to say up front, because not only do I think Bone Temple is a superior film, I think it's arguably the best film of this franchise. Every element of it is fascinating. And like Alan said, the direction is more steady and assured than definitely the last one, which takes some big swings. It's very, like, I did like that it's not just a continuation of the Spike story. It is in some ways, in some important ways, but it really seems to be embracing a completely new direction and a new tone and a new focus. It's also very funny as well. The entire plot line of Ray Fiennes, what's his name? Dr. Kelson?
Dr. Mm-hmm. Kelson, yeah.
And Samson, the alpha, essentially becoming stoner buddies, really funny in ways that it's not just absurd and humorous, but it leans so fittingly into the themes of like madness that have taken over this world. And the resulting mm-hmm. film, I think, is quite deranged. And I really, really love that about this. Just a quick note. I think I'm remembering that the first film, I had noted on the pod that it almost feels like a Brexit allegory,
mm-hmm.
and about the kind of cultish thinking that isolated communities begin to rely upon. Yeah. And this film seems much less interested in that and more interested in the relationship between science and religion.
Yes.
Yes.
And it poses this through the figure of Ray Fiennes, or mm-hmm. Dr. Kelson, as a doctor, because he is therefore a man of science, but he's also the only character thus far in the reboot storyline who resembles a priest, right? Someone who grants comfort and grants absolution and grants last rites. That's almost literally something he's doing in the film. And so for that reason alone, it's such a reshift from the focuses of the last film. And the last film was more of a coming of age adventure. And so I really dug that mm-hmm. and thought it was just fascinating.
All right, Abe, back to you. 20 years later, what is your favorite film of last year? What did you think of The Bone Temple?
Certainly was my favorite film last year. I thought The Bone Temple, very much like what Mike and Alan were talking about, I think that it is different in different ways, in very positive ways. I quite enjoyed this movie as well. I think that it is stylistically different than Danny Boyle kind of using iPhones in, you know, this bullet time effect. And it's a little bit more in a different line of story. It's still the same story arc that Alex Garland kind of begins in the 20 years later, but the Bone Temple kind of focuses much more on Kelson. And what I thought was very fascinating was, yes, like this idea of science versus religion, like what Mike's talking about. Also, the ideas of lost generations. So this Jimmy character has grown up. Basically, the last glimpse that he has of his father is that his father was infected and kind of allowing this horde of zombies to overrun the small little village that he lived in. And so he believes himself to be the son of Satan and to carry on this demonic continuation of I guess just hate and ill actions charity? Across. What's that?
It's charity.
It's charity. Yeah, he describes it as charity. But to keep ravaging the Isle of England with it, you know, the idea of growing up without parents and then just kind of like really being a like a cult leader and not really knowing what that even means, but kind of just enjoying this power play. And so I agree with Alan that discussion that he has with Kelson toward the middle act of this movie or the middle part of this movie is very fascinating because he kind of finds some solace in sort of his past thoughts and sort of what he's going through today. And in large part, Alex Garland's script, I think, is still asking a lot of really fascinating questions. The way that I thought about the Samson and the Kelson characters was a little bit more, you know, previously, exactly what Mike was talking about. I thought about the end of Empire and stuff like that, which I talked about in the top 10 episode. But for this one, it was a little bit more of like coexistence, right? So allowing yourself to possibly, not possibly, but like the idea of like England kind of allowing itself to be graceful in allowing to be graceful in getting new immigration into the country and living and coexisting and kind of rebuilding with this. So that's, it was very fascinating to see that with the Samson character in this one. So I think Alex Garland is still hitting quite hard in what he's trying to get across in these movies. Nia DaCosta does a great job of showcasing what she can do from a storytelling standpoint, but also quite a visceral, like horror movie standpoint of just, you know, skinning people alive or having like a deep cut on an arm. Like there's some really great stuff that she's got going on. A lot of screams in my theater when I was watching it with people. It was actually really fun to watch people's reactions to it. But 28 Years, Bone Temple, continuation of the Alex Garland ideas in a different pathway, but still in on its own, a really good movie.
Yeah, can I just jump in real quick, Aaron, just to say I'm really fascinated by that read, which is that, you know, this film is about immigration and cohabitation and coexistence and things like that. And, you know, thinking about it, it makes it really significant that Samson is a person of color.
Correct. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That's all.
Yeah.
This movie is certainly the most brutal of the franchise, and this is not a franchise that's, you know, restraint has never been a part of the 28 series, but this one really goes to town on things. I quite like this movie as well. I'm about on par with Years with this one, where like I think they're both like exceedingly well made and very good movies. I guess I want to see like what this trilogy's supposed to be. Because I'm so fascinated by Garland's approach to coming back to this world and wanting to say something. Because it seems very clear that, you know, it's not like Sony was like, it seems very obvious that like Garland had it and perhaps Boyle together, but mainly Garland had like an idea that spanned three movies as opposed to Sony being like, hey, why not make three instead of just one 28 years later? It's like, no, it's like, it feels like, okay, if we're going to finally tap back into this IP, I have a really cool way to like tell three different stories that are going to like have this overarching theme and different characters, what have you. I want to see what that third movie is going to be, because the looking at this now, like you guys have already mentioned the first film and the 28 years later and what that's about. And yes, especially when you make that movie now and it's coming so far after, it's hard to not get into talks about Brexit, let alone, you know, the pandemic and how that will relate to a series like this in a very obvious ways. But that film's also about family, right? It's like very much about like family in different ways, as far as Spike's coming of age and what he's dealing with his father and his mother and what have you. Mm-hmm. This film seems to be all about evil and like all the different ways we could look at the evil in the world.
Well, you could also think about it with Spike growing up in the first one, and he's the main character of his story, because growing up as a child, it's about you. But now that he's moved on from that, he sees how evil the world can be.
Sure.
Yeah. And this movie's very much focused on that from different angles, right? So it's giving you this Jimmy gang, which is just like the worst. I mean, like it's this guy who projects himself as the literal son of Satan,
right,
who has seven fingers, which is a weird number to have for this, but, and you know, puts things through these charity trials that are horrific and have you. And at the same time, you have Samson as a basically, you know, like the third, fourth lead in this movie,
yeah,
who is also like a form of evil in terms of there's this virus inside of him that makes him hate everything and want to rip, you know, heads off of necks and what have you.
Right.
And on that side of things, well, we're at least trying to treat the evil, but there's still something there. Like, it's, I find all that really fascinating. Well, Garland's like trying to like put all together in this big stew. And that leads me to, and there's more to say about this one, but that leads me to like, what's the next one going to be? Like, what's the, especially if it's a wrap up trilogy, like there's going to be a supposed ending to all of this, I guess, retribution in some way, or, you know, some kind of,
who knows,
something that kind of like makes things better. Like, I do, yeah, like there's some sense of
hope. He's either going to end it with an optimistic or a pessimistic view.
I mean, given where this film goes, I mean, there's certainly the option to have it have some kind of hopeful view, but I don't know. But regardless, this film, you know, it's as dark as it gets, as brutal as it gets, while also being, yes, very funny at times, given the way that Kelson and Samson interact. But the work done to make all of these scenes work, I think, is really expertly handled by DaCosta. Like, this is such a, you know, it's, I don't think it's an easy task to say, hey, do something that, do take on a Danny Boyle franchise and do something similar, because Danny Boyle is such an interesting director as far as how much challenge he puts in front of himself as far as camera choices and angles and different formats or what have you. That's why I like 28 Weeks Later quite a bit, because I do think the director of that one, but that's going to bug me. Juan Carlos Frazio, I think he does a good job of getting a handle around the style of that movie and how to replicate it in his own unique way. This movie, yes, it's more straightforward. It doesn't have the kind of the like 360 move shots that was going on with the iPhones, what have you, that were in 20 years later, but it's still, it, she directs the hell out of this movie. I mean, we get to this whole late sequence that we're kind of dancing around where Ralph Fiennes has to put on a performance, and it is incredible. Like, it is wild to watch.
So good.
And it's something that, you know, if we're not going to use the what's it, the Young Fathers for the score like we did in the last movie, which I thought was really great, she's got a great choice of needle drops in this movie that really make up for it, including that one scene, including like other moments that speak to what Kelson's trying to do or whatnot, or like, you know, go into the emotions of other scenes that are taking place. So there's a lot here that I really, really liked. Would it make more sense to like have Spike more involved in the narrative? I don't know. I can understand that being perhaps a gripe with some people, that he's just kind of, after going through a whole coming of age journey, he's just kind of whimpering in the background for most of this movie. But it's like,
he's like a witness to the movie, not necessarily a part of the movie.
Yeah, and I can see that.
I just like that actor, and I wish they gave him a little bit more to do.
I can agree there. At the same time, it's like, well, he's with a group of psychopaths. I don't know what he's going to do. It's going to be all that scenario.
He's going to be crying most of the time.
Like, he's still 12. Like,
exactly.
Like, he didn't grow up that much. Like, so, and but no, I was a fan of this film.
You were kind of jumping to it, and I don't want to spend too much time here, but it's certainly, the box office has not been super kind. And also, I agree with Alan that, you know, hopefully word of mouth spreads and people go see this. Mm-hmm. But this is also what I thought about during the movie, which is what does happen in this third one. And I hope that I do see it.
It's been green lit, supposedly, like that they keep saying it.
Yeah. Cause again, I get a little bit cautious of what's happening in Hollywood with all the consolidation of movie studios and stuff. But in any case,
Sony just signed a big contract with Netflix, so well, let's hope.
And also, Sony's going to have a good year this year, so that's not, I'm not too worried. Like, this, you know, this is a $60 billion movie. That's not chump change for some of us, but I mean,
I'll write you a check right now, Aaron.
They can handle this, as well as, it's not like this was a bomb as far as both nobody liked it and nobody saw it. It's like the best reviewed entry in the series right now. Like, it's got rave reviews.
Quite heartened by that, actually.
Yeah, it's the internet loves it.
Yeah. So, it has an A- cinema score compared to the B A-. of the first one. Wow. In horror movies, that's incredible. So,
I'm surprised by that. Maybe there's like the cold dancing sequence. I want to ask Mike to expound upon the science versus religion aspect that you're kind of alluding to, and kind of what you thought about that, Mike.
Oh, well, I mean, so if we accept this as Kelson's story, like, Ralph Fiennes, for one thing, is the MVP of the film, right? I think we sometimes forget not just that he's obviously this really stellar dramatic actor, but he's also a very talented comedic actor, right? It's not that, and I didn't mean to imply earlier that the film kind of skids into outright comedy, but the kind of subtle, absurd humor of it, like, is really captured by Ralph Fiennes in some pretty amazing ways. But in terms of centering him as like the man of science, and then Jemmy is his own kind of man of faith, I think this is where you can see Alex Garland's fingerprints the most, because I think he's taking a really clear political side in favor of science, not just as true and factual as opposed to false prophecy represented by Jemmy, mm-hmm. but also he presents science as the basis for empathy, right? And decency, because by its nature, science is not based in fear or bias or control. I think the thesis of the movie, one might argue, is that faith is rooted in fear, which ultimately makes it cruel and based in hierarchies, whereas science has a leveling effect that allows people to recognize shared traits and patterns. And that's what that's the Samson story. Right. And this is what I mean when I say Ralph Fiennes, and maybe, you know, maybe I'm thinking of Conclave too much, but he does essentially play the role of a priest, the steward of this temple.
Yeah.
I think the film is being suggestive, at least, that science and faith are not necessarily antithetical to one another. When it's done the right way, it's power that gets you into trouble, and faith is more akin to that than it is to science.
Yeah, I certainly can see that with. No, that lands a lot, because again, the ideas came up in my head too, and especially that conversation with Jemmy and Kelson. Yeah. But the influence of power, and I guess the way that you know, you mentioned the sort of religion kind of riding on fear kind of thing, and that's how Jemmy runs his group, is like through fear, through intimidation, through like killing. And that's kind of how he lives his life. And it's in large part all that he's known is like the violence of the world. And so he kind of reflects that back almost like sevenfold, I guess, if he has seven fingers. But it was just fascinating to hear Kelson be like, you hear voices in your head right now. And like, what do they speak to you about? And basically just like, maybe you have a lot of problems and I can try and help you solve them. But it was just a really cool read and scene to see them hash things out in a very calm manner, and then things he still has to proposition him, right? So yeah, it's a really good read.
It's interesting to watch that scene play out as far as how aware Jemmy seems to suddenly be about his positioning, given like everything that's happened to his fingers and what have you. And now it's like it's not just a matter of, you know, I found this crazy doctor in the woods and I have certain ideas. It's like, I see what's going on, and I have a proposition for you,
right?
As far as how to keep a certain level of control. So it makes me wonder, what's Jimmy's like goal? Like what, like, especially if he always has to have seven fingers, so he's like, his group never expands. What's he after beyond just,
well, there was a moment later in the movie where he, through the barter, he says, we can expand and make more fingers and make more fists, so we cover the aisle. Didn't you say something along those lines?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So I think one, like the mandates that Satan tells him.
Also, I just think he just picks random fingers. Like he saw that one guy in the beginning with that house, and he's like, "You want to be part of the fingers now? You want to, you know?" I just think I don't think he has a plan.
That's, well, yeah, that's kind of my point. I'm like, I don't, and that's, you know, crazy be crazy. So I don't, and I know that's dismissive.
Crazy,
I know
there's, be crazy.
I know that's dismissive. I know there's more to it than that. But at the same time, it's also like, I mean, the beginning of this movie is brutal, right? He, like, you've gone from the end of the first one where Jemmy seemingly helps Spike by like taking on the various, you know, infected that are around him. And now we're watching him in this abandoned pool where he's been like forced to be like, all right, you got to kill one of my guys, or if you want to stay in my group.
Right.
And there's, you know, clearly to put him in, to put Spike in that situation, clearly Jemmy must see something in him, right? If he sees this kid who's presumably been surviving on his own, Jemmy must see something in Spike to be like, well, this kid seems to know how to get along. So I'm going to try him out. If he can murder one of my people, then he can be in our group. And it's rough. Watch. I've seen this movie twice, and that scene both times watching it, where he finds a way to get the upper hand. It's brutal, given like the circumstances, and like you're watching it play out. And even when like a hit happens, like the guy who gets hit like, he doesn't, like, he starts laughing before he realizes, like, realizes it, before he realizes, like, I'm going to die. Like, this is this is it for me. Like, it's
really good blood splatter effect on that one.
Really rough stuff.
Yeah, so the audience was, like, pretty cringed out. I just want to add to that, too, the idea of, you know, Sir Jimmy kind of setting up these, like, tribunals or, like, these test cases. I don't know what his rhyme or reason is either, because he basically does this with a different group of people later on in the movie, like 20 minutes later, with, like, another young man in
this
bar situation. So it's like, I don't know, like, does he just need to change these people out ever so often to prove that he's got the strongest of the strong? I have no idea. But it is quite, it's quite barbaric in what he's doing.
Well, I also, he has the education of an 8-year-old.
Correct, yeah. That,
he doesn't know, much, like, how much more, like, if he, you know, this shows you, you need parents because they'll teach you not to be this way.
But well, to that effect, though, the fact, I'm trying to project, you know, what Alex Garland might be thinking. So this is entirely speculation. But, you know, the fact that Jimmy is the son of a pastor is really important, right? So he's already familiar with or able to readily adopt the language of or to mobilize, rather, the language of devotion and faith toward controlling people. That seems really purposeful. And so to me, it just seems like a really damning commentary on one simple truth, right? Which is that there's no amount of evil people aren't willing to commit, and there's no amount of lapses in logic they're willing to accommodate themselves when they're convinced they have divine permission.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Just kind of a truism across civilization. And that seems to me kind of the kind of core theme that Jimmy represents. The question I had, though, there's no indication that Sir Jimmy is abusing his the seven fingers sexually.
No,
right?
I wouldn't say that. No. Not that I was kind of worried there.
I didn't think that was going on either, but it makes me wonder, why is he so obviously based on Jimmy Savile?
Well, when Jimmy Savile got the scandal and everything broke was after he died. If this happened in 2001 and
it's
he was
before
that
all
age,
that it's before all that came out, right?
Yeah, so in 2001 when he's watching Teletubbies and Jimmy Savile was like a children's star. Everybody loved him. He was part of the thing. So he probably based it all off of that. And he wouldn't have known that Jimmy was a world-class piece of shit.
Right. I think that's the cinematic irony of it. The fact that he's basing on this guy that he has no idea about, and he is actually now become just as bad as
for other reasons.
For different reasons, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so Jimmy Savile's sort of posthumous, the revelation, the scandal, that happened in time for Sir Jimmy to know what that was about?
It happened after, so he wouldn't have known.
Yeah. Right. So clearly this is working on some level of metaphor, right? Like England's sins. Yes. It's not just about this notorious sex predator. It's about the kind of cover up and the culture of silence around it. And that, you know, seems like an extension of things going on in the first film. Because if the first film is kind of circling around themes of COVID or Brexit or whatever, depending on your interpretation, this one seems to speak to the moment we're in, which is cultures of silence and complacency around ethno-religious superstition and the place that those things have in our society. When you have like one of the most notorious sex predators around kind of being perverted into a symbol of unifying power, that there's kind of a perverse irony in that.
I wouldn't be surprised if there's a version of the script that might have even had that element, but it might be at some point either Sony or Alex Garland was like, maybe that's a little too far. Like, we already got a lot going on as it is. Maybe I don't need to add a psychosexual element at the same time as everything else that's happening in this movie. That's, of course, obviously speculation, but it's like, how about this? As I said, this is the most brutal film in the series. Like, there's so much happening here. To throw on top of that like he rapes his fingers or whatever, it's like, well, who's it helping at this point? I get that the idea of having a Jimmy Savile coded character obviously invites a lot of discourse. That's not on accident, but I can see why toning things down a bit in that regard, especially in today's age where like trying to do anything sexually related in a horror movie, R-rated or otherwise, it's already going to get like a lot more discourse than maybe studios want to have to deal with. Like, I can get it. I can understand.
Yeah. And in large part, I do think that the idea that is represented in this movie, that Jim Savile, but also this, again, this idea of these children that were raised off of television, whether it be Teletubbies and everything else, Alex Garland does have a point of view that he's trying to come across on this, which is, hey, by the way, you could all become sort of this monotone type of singular idea-brained folks that might get you into some trouble here and there if you're following some sort of cult of personality type of thing. And it could be, for modern-day stuff, it could be like streamers or it could be like influencers or what have you. So it, I think that there still is this older Jimmy Savile metaphor, but baked onto a present day, like media might be a little bit much for these children who are a little bit too young to know what's happening, but they still do it anyway, which is what you see actually happen out or expand out in these fingers. Cause I actually really like when one of the fingers is like, you know, this is all just like bullshit anyway. Right. It's like, well, she's grown beyond it. You know what I mean? She's grown, she's matured into her own and kind of realized that, oh, I am more mature now, and I realize that these things that I did were probably wrong, but also, yeah, like, when you look back at your 12-year-old self, and you're just like, I did some stupid stuff back then, that is a bad thing. Or, I mean, I'm glad that's a course correction in your own life, but if you were to kind of just forcefully and coerced to do these things, it's a terrible thing to think about for just, like, your own psyche growing up, which is why I think those Jimmys, like, as weird and, you know, strange as they are, like, they all carry like some weird sense of some self-hatred, but also just like some, a lot of like, what's the term I'm looking for, where you're just like not readily there, like psychologically at the age that you should be. I forget that term, but you're just not really
desensitized.
Not desensitized, but
you mean like self-cognizance.
You mean no, it's a little bit more like you're just, you know, you're basically like mentally aged down, even though you're like 18. I forget what that term is.
Like arrested development.
Development of some kind. Yeah. So they're all just like looking for some kind of leadership and some sort of like father figure or mother figure. So it's very fascinating to see.
It's interesting to think about in terms of like, if you just, you know, strip it down to its bare basics, that you have the villain of the film who is a Jimmy Savile type character who is exploiting and lying to and amassing this sort of congregation of youngsters who have no idea. So one of them is like bright enough to gradually figure out, like you say, but for the most part, they're unaware of how badly they're being exploited.
Right.
You know, analogous to in his own way to Jimmy Savile. Oh, and he's also like an agent of Satan. Except he's not even sincere about it, right? That's like a pretty, pretty easy, way to villainize someone. But I think the deeper kind of thesis of the movie is that the kind of cultish celebrity persona that you can build and that grants you a certain degree of flexibility in exploiting people and having that go unchallenged for decades in the case of Jimmy Savile is only millimeters away from people who do that through faith. Right, religious leaders who do essentially a similar type of thing. And so if you want to make it about sexual predation, then the Catholic Church is an obvious analogy here, but also just any kind of sort of religious misuse of power, I think, as being essentially in the same category is something that I think is impossible to ignore here.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I certainly thought of the movie The Master while trying this too. They're very different, but the ideas of just power control, seizing that control, continuation of that control, and sort of the people that can stray from it and kind of realize things as for what they are.
I find all this quite fascinating. I want to talk about Chai Lewis Perry, who plays Samson, because I don't think that's the kind of performance that's going to get nearly enough credit as it deserves for what he's doing. For one thing, I want to point out the way they make him is like they made like body suits that he had to wear every time they shot his scenes. And they're only like one time use only. So they're like six or seven body suits they use total to get his scenes down. But that's like how they make Samson, which makes sense when you think about like all the stuff on his chest there, like all the wounds and everything, let alone the fact that he's completely naked the entire time. So it's like, that's how they did Samson. But even then, there's a real good physical performance here that really, like, it's very important to the film that it works as well as it does. You know, I could rely on Ralph Fiennes to be Ralph Fiennes. He's Ralph Fiennes. He's one of our greatest actors. Chai Lewis Perry has to play this monster that we're able to kind of find empathy within and show an evolution of change to some degree. And the fact that this film is able to do that as well as it does, I found to be quite impressive. For one thing, this is the first time we get a film that shows us the perspective of the infected.
Right.
We get to see him looking at something else and seeing, like, rage come out of it. And, like, so that's what they see. They see rage coming back at them, and therefore they have to attack that rage. Later on, as Kelson begins treating him, we get to see more of what his perspective is, whether it's him just looking at the stars, or later on when he's having kind of flashbacks to be rage virus time, and watching it. I think it's very subtle in the face, watching that kind of the remove that happens, where it becomes less bulging eyes, veins, and everything that kind of make him look as angry as possible, and you kind of see a calmness that,
like, he's stoic, yeah.
Very stoic. I think there's, I can't be for sure on this, if I've only seen it so many times, but, like, I think there's a deliberate makeup choice in the face specifically that, like, toned down more and more of what Samson is, that reflects that change going on. And I think it's really, really good work from this actor that to kind of take this, you know, non-speaking part and make it work in tandem with Kelson and everything else going on around it as well as it does.
Mm-hmm. It did provide a lot of the last, like what Mike was saying, in my audience as well, with them just kind of like zoning out with each other. But I don't want to get into spoiler territory just yet, but I did enjoy the ideas of the rage virus, what it is, what it could be, possibly what Kelson might be doing with it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it's quite different from other quote-unquote zombie movies, even though I think that there have been movies that sort of follow a similar path of scientists working on things. But in any case, I enjoyed Chiluse Perry's his acting in this, especially because, as you were saying, Aaron, it evolves through the course of this movie too, and that is quite nuanced, but I enjoyed it for what it was.
It seems like it ties into something Abe was talking about earlier, too, in terms of sort of acceptance of immigrants and finding ways to coexist on the planet. The idea that what Kelson discovers, I guess, or stumbles upon, is that what we view as this sort of rage-induced hostility is really just a form of psychosis.
Yeah.
That, or as a form of shared madness that can be addressed and treated and possibly deprogrammed. Now, I hasten to note that I don't think that means the infected are the immigrants. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, that would be a little problematic. I think in terms of, like, actual hostility, rage, and violence, that's, I think, more attributable to, like, right-wing backlashes against immigration. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, like, living in, I mean, he just made a movie called Civil War, right? He's right. Kind of thinking about political polarization and how it's ripping communities apart, and to say, no, even the angriest and the most dangerous, and in the case of America, the most armed of us, have a capacity to kind of, like, snap out of it if we can just sort of, like, key in and figure out that, no, this is rage. Yeah. It's not a permanent psychosis, or it's not a permanent condition. It is something that can be treated and deprogrammed. I think that's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
So that's what brings me all the way back to, I have no idea what the third movie's going to be.
Sure.
Without spoiling anything for this movie, it's like, for one thing, it feels like we're, like, I didn't think that we'd see, like, more Aaron Taylor Johnson in this movie, but, like, it seems like we're even further away from even having that being a factor in the next movie, as far as Spike ever going back to his home, you know, on the causeway, on the island out there.
Yeah.
I have no idea where we're going next, let alone given all the work that's done with Kelson and where he winds up at the end of this movie. I don't know what the next step is in that regard either. It's something that he perhaps knows that others won't, because he's the only one that knows. So it's like,
yeah,
where are we going with all this? I'm fascinated by this. Like, I
am too.
I hesitate to say, like, there's some hopeful ending to all of this. I think it's possible, but at the same time, it's like, well, what else do we do? We've seen, because as I mentioned, like, this film is very much about, like, the evils. And I know it's easy to be like, man's actually the worst of all. But, you know, it's not the zombies that are bad. It's but, like, yeah, okay, so now we've delved into the deepest of dark as far as watching fucking Jimmy skin people alive and all this stuff. Where do we go from here? What's the thing that Alex Zarron and Danny Boyle are like, okay, we finally have our ideas for what we want to do with the, bringing back of the series. We've already danced around the idea of taking it to the rest of the world, and then we immediately said no to that. So, like, what's next? Like,
where do we go? Curious, and this is the power of movies, is, like, I'm excited. And that's something that I can't really say that I've felt it for a while, you know? I've been excited for some movies here and there, but it's, like, just being able to live through these two movies that are so plot-forward and so full of ideas, and again, embarking on different kind of type of quests, whether it be Spike or Kelson or, you know, Samson or this Jimmy character or anybody else in this world, I'm very excited to see what happens. That's why I'm if they need to crowdsource it, I'm happy to crowdsource the funds.
I'll give money. Let's go.
Yeah, same.
Well, I think it's just so invigorating to see major studio movies coming out with these kind of ideas and this kind of massive release. It's just really exciting, and I'm really, really, really hyped to see the next one, and hopefully we get more movies like this, but it's not looking like it.
Well, I'm a little ambivalent. I mean, I'm excited for the next one. I'm curious to see where it goes. Boyle is directing the third one.
I kind of
wish someone else was to take it in yet another direction, so we get three distinct perspectives on the material, although it's not to knock his kind of handle on the franchise. But I do think Garland definitely recognizes across two films, not that there's only so much repetition you can have of just people running away from the infected. Right. And so, you know, the previous film introduced some new ideas, but with the exception of Samson becoming a bigger character, he also just is content to drop these ideas. You know, like we thoroughly abandoned one of the bigger question marks of the first film, which has to do with an infected baby. And so, it's unclear to me whether or not they're just sort of that there is a master plan in place or that they're I'm not entirely convinced they intend to wrap everything up. I think you can make the argument that the franchise works best when it's a little bit gonzo.
Sure.
But it does make me wonder if they're just kind of throwing things against the wall to see what works. And
I mean, I would agree that there's maybe not like a narrative wrap up that's necessary for something like this, because that's the joy of zombie movies. They don't really end for me, at least. But I do think a thematic wrap up makes a lot of sense as far as how you get onto something like this. I think that it seems like Garland has very distinct stories he wants to tell. And then he'll have that out of his system.
Well, yeah, this film ends with a scene I'm not going to spoil, but I also don't know that it was necessary to include this scene. I feel like maybe it was kind of a tighter wrap up without it, but it does end with some dialogue about World War II and the need for alliances among the allies or something like that, which felt a little symbolically heavy handed in terms of where, if anything's going to kind of tease the core themes of the next film, that seemed to be the biggest.
Well, that's kind of where I thought about Alex Garland's Civil War as well. You know, he certainly has ideas about these things. But I think to both yours, Aaron's, and Alan's points about everything, it's like, I love when movies are kind of gonzo. It's kind of like my jam. And I actually really like the idea of like, well, we explored this, but let's leave it. Like, we don't necessarily need to go back to it, whether it be the Isle or even in this movie, there's another woman that is like, you know, Spike has to go after, but like, we never really find out what happens to that person anyway. But I'm just like, well, if she pops up, great. If she doesn't, you know, she was good in the 30 minutes that she was on screen.
I'd argue, by the way, the final scene in this movie that we won't talk about, I think it's a lot like the first movie as far as it's basically an epilogue. Like, we've already, the movie's ended at that point, and we're just getting, instead of making audiences wait for a post-credit scene that would have that scene, they just put it there now. I think that's a better way to look at like how that scene functions. I'm not saying that makes the movie better or worse, what have you. I think that's the function of a scene like that, where if it was a Marvel movie, people would be trained to know to stay at the end of the movie. But this is 28 days later. People don't necessarily think they got to stay the whole time, so they're going to just throw everything at you at once.
I will say that I was surprised, because I was not, either I'd forgotten about it and or I just was like not thinking about it, and I was like, hey, cool, that's neat that they they're tying this in.
There was a spontaneous applause in my crowd.
My crowd was into it.
Wow. You got like, I should go to your theaters.
Yeah.
There was two applause breaks for very specific reasons in my screenings.
One of them was the dance sequence.
One of them obviously was the ending sequence of Great Fights.
Are we going to continue tiptoeing around it?
I mean, is there anything you want to say about it?
Well, I was thinking about just it rules. It's mind blowing. Makes me wish Voldemort had a scene like that. But as I'm thinking about and the conversation we've been having, it seems My appreciation for that scene is growing as we talk more about the themes of the movie amongst ourselves, because it strikes me as just being a really complex scene, not only because it's funny and bizarre and it works as a spectacle, but I think it's working on multiple levels, because it's partly about Dr. Kelsen wants to put on a show, right? Well, now, maybe it's partly due to his own nihilism, or maybe he's just bored, but he really commits to what his projects are, right? Like laboriously erecting this bone temple over the course of years, right? He really gives these things his all. So there's kind of a mischievous or playful side to Dr. Kelsen that's really kind of interesting. And Ralph Fiennes is really good at working on multiple levels here, but it's also his way of ridiculing Jimmy, mm-hmm. right? Because he's showing us that religion is theatrical. It's the mechanisms by which you win people over. But the whole point of that scene is that it's completely insincere, right? And I think that there's some real commentary there that ties into everything we've been saying.
I have to go watch this again.
It's so good. Yeah, it's him. One, it's him having the best time of his life, probably like his best day in years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But he's also very much like, this is all show. This is all nonsense.
Yeah,
and it's how really everybody eats it up.
Yeah.
I do enjoy how Ralph Fiennes wears basically just one piece of clothing every single day, but the second he gets called on to do some performance, like, oh yeah, let me get my goth costume out of the closet.
He's been waiting for it, man.
This was his calling.
Finally, I can use the other piece of clothing I own.
Exactly. Yeah. I had no need for that tonight.
It's like, I had this mascara just in case.
Yeah. Just a bunch of body ash.
Also, the fact that that's the cover of the poster, and I would have never.
I would have never guessed.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
It's a good misleading ads, for sure.
Yeah. I'd seen some stuff online, people were like, this is the best scene of the year. And I was like, seems interesting. And then I watched it, I was like, you know, Ralph Fiennes can do everything.
This is the best scene of the last, like, few years. This is the best scene since COVID. This is so good.
How much of that is Ralph Fiennes?
That's a good question. 50-50?
Not to take anything away. Yeah. Not to take anything away from how mind-blowing this scene is, but I wonder how much of that is, how much of it they let him do it, because there's a lot of flames.
Did you see the return, Mike?
Oh, was that the Odysseus thing?
That's the Odysseus movie? I quite enjoyed it for what it was doing. It's the return of the movie of Ralph Fiennes. It came out a couple years ago. I think
2024.
And it focuses on the final chapter of the Odyssey, where Odysseus finally does get back home, and it's about his whole work to eventually get with his wife and everything again. But Ralph Fiennes is cut in that movie. Like, he worked out. He did all the work necessary to be, like, in the best shape possible. Mm-hmm. So it's like, I'm not saying that solely alone means that he probably did all the flame stunts and everything involved. It was like, I wouldn't be surprised if he certainly had more hands-on involvement than
there was a guy that was credited for the suit.
I'm sure there's always credit to stunts, for sure. Credit to stunts and pyro and everything that goes on and all these kind of things, for sure. Yeah. I'd like to think that Ralph Fiennes probably does, you know, take an active role in trying to be a part of these things. Yeah. Also, that movie and this movie, plenty of Ralph Fiennes' penis. That's
good to know.
You need to know what's going on down there. Those are these two movies.
Writing it down on my palm pad right now.
You're next, Matt Damon.
We'll see how they compare this summer.
All right. Anything else on 28 Years Later, The Bone Temple?
I'm curious. Did you guys see it in premium formats? Or I guess, Alan, did you not 40X it, but just a larger
I saw it in Dolby Cinema at AMC. It was good. It sounded great. Okay. We don't have like a real IMAX out here.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, Dolby Cinema to me is probably one of the better options here.
Yeah.
But also, we have RPX out here, but, you know, whatever.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, for one thing, it just didn't have that option for me. I mean, that RPX, I just didn't have. When I saw it the first time just in a regular screening room, but it was not a screening, but it was a regular theater, but wasn't a fancy theater, just a decent one. And then the second time I saw it, I couldn't see it in an RPX. So I just saw it in the biggest non premium theater they had. And so, but yeah, you know. It does the job.
It does, yeah.
Great. All right. Well, 28 years later, The Bone Temple is currently playing in theaters. Alan, when should people go and see this movie?
Now. Right now. Go right now. This instant. Go yesterday.
Mike?
Yeah, same. I didn't realize till you guys were talking that it's struggling at the box office. So go help it out. We want a third one.
Abe?
Yeah, go see it now in theaters. I would highly recommend it.
Yeah, I think this is just quality horror entertainment with a lot of smart minds behind it. So go see it. See it right away. Okay, well, let's move on. Let's, hey, what time is it over here?
I think it's time for a quick game here. Little yeah. known fact, that's actually the tune that plays when Kelson starts up his little, like, fire pit to get the skin off of Bones. But then, you know, Nita Costa was like, Aaron, we don't really want sound for this. It's kind of more of like a somber thing.
So oh, I thought Aaron just went, sorry, you can't afford me.
I'll have to work that one into the next one. I've got a game for you guys this week. It's called Sequel, Sequel, Sequels. This is basically just on a scale of where I will read you guys a sequel. Each one of you will give me what you think the Rotten Tomatoes score is. Closest to the Rotten Tomatoes score gets it. I do have tie breaks for each one of these if you guys get the same answer or the same difference in number apart. Alan and Mike, you guys are guests of the show. If you guys could choose, Alan, you first, a number between 1 and 100.
I'll do 47.
And Mike, what about you?
Just any number? 72. Any
number. The answer was 77. So, Mike, you go first. For the movie Split, what do you think the Rotten Tomatoes percentage score for Split is? M. Night Shyamalan Split.
High 70s.
Is there a number that you got?
79. How about
79? Okay. Alan, what about you?
75.
And Aaron, what about you?
That's where I was going. So I guess I'll say 73.
73. The answer, 79 on the dot. Mike.
Oh, for
that one. Alan, we got it to you. Before Sunset, the second of the Before trilogy.
Uh-huh.
What do you think the Rotten Tomatoes percentage score is?
Oh, that's going to be high. 95.
95. Aaron, we go to you.
Be bold to say 100, so I won't. I'll say 98.
98. And Mike, we go to you.
I'll go under. I'll say 92.
92. The answer, 94. Alan, you get that one.
Oh, good. I was like, is it Price is Right rules?
Now, it is in some ways, but for the most part, like we the closest to get it. So you were one away. Mike was two away. Aaron was four away.
Yeah. So if I said 93, we would have had to split that.
I would have had a tiebreaker. I would ask you what the Metacritic score is.
Oh, dear.
Aaron, you got to go first in the second one. Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior.
They're all well-reviewed movies. 94.
94. Mike, we go to you.
I'll do 92 again.
92 again.
So let it ride.
Let it ride. Alan, we go to you.
So it was, fuck, I don't know. 92. What was the other number?
92 and 94.
I'll do 93 then.
93. The answer, 93 on the dot. Alan, you get that point. the next one here, we go back to you, Mike. Blade 2. Guillermo del Toro's Blade 2.
Oh. 70.
70. Alan?
Sixty-six.
And Aaron?
Yeah, the Blades are weirdly underrated. I'm gonna say 57.
57. The answer, Passenger 57 on the dot. Aaron, you get that.
Damn.
That's low.
Yeah, both Blade 1 and 2 are like both like right under 60 for some reason. Like, really? All right.
Well, 2 in particular to be higher.
2 is amazing. Yeah.
2 is very good.
Wait, what's Blade Trinity?
Trinity's rightfully like in the 30s or 20s. If
it
that.
Has to be. I didn't look it up. But yeah. Alan, we go back to you. Captain America, The Winter Soldier.
Oh, I think that one was pretty well. I'm going to say 88.
88 miles per hour. Aaron, we go to you.
It's pretty strong. I'll say 86.
86. And Mike, what is your guess?
I was going to say 88, so I'll say 89.
89. You went up, which is the right move because it was 90.
Oh.
So, Mike, you get that one. Aaron, we go back to you to start here. Spider-Man 2, Sam Raimi's Spider-Man 2.
Okay. Is it that high, though? Like, I feel like there might be, like, a... I'm going to test myself and say 88.
88 miles per hour. Mike, what do you think?
94.
94. Aaron or Alan?
92.
Mike and Alan, you guys both went away. The answer on Rotten Tomatoes is 93.
It is 93, okay.
So the tiebreak here is a Metacritic score. Mike, you went first, so you will get you the first stab here. What is the Metacritic score for Spider-Man 2? Keep in mind the scale is also 0 to 100, but they are much more conservative.
I don't know how to convert from metric to, you know. I don't know. What's a high? I imagine it's high. What's a high Metacritic? So 80, 90.
70 plus is considered good on Metacritic.
Okay. Now, 88.
88. Wow. Okay.
Is that high?
That is quite high for Metacritic. But Alan, what do you think it is?
I'll just say like 81.
81. The answer, 83 on Metacritic. Alan, you get that point.
Oh, thank you.
So it is a quite a strongly reviewed movie.
So what's a movie that's gotten really high on Metacritic?
The classics. Ricky Sinicki.
Not Ricky Sinicki. But I mean, like, so something like Paddington Godfather. 2 might have gotten like 90 or something like that, which is incredible. I think Alan, did you go first in that last one, Alan? Or Aaron, you did.
Sam
Raimi's. Yeah. So we go back to you, Mike, to go first. For Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, this is the second of that reboot trilogy. Okay. Apes Together Strong with Koba.
Oh, low 91.
Alan, what about you?
I don't know. Who was in that? That was with
Toby Kebbell. He's dual wielding.
Gary Oldman.
Gary Oldman.
Oh, that one did pretty well. 92.
And Aaron, what about you?
Where are we at? Where are the others?
91 and 92.
All right.
So increasing.
93.
The answer, Mike on the dot, 91. Alan, we go back to you. Pearl. This is the second of the Pearl trilogy.
Pearl.
Yeah, the horror movie Pearl. What do you think the Rotten Tomatoes percentage is?
That was pretty well reviewed. 92.
Aaron, what about you?
89.
And Mike, what about you?
I'll go under 88.
88 miles per hour. The answer, 93, Alan.
Oh.
That one.
Nice.
Yeah. Just a few more here. Aaron, The Naked Gun 2.5, : The Smell of Fear.
61.
Mike, what about you? It's comedy.
Yeah, 65.
And Alan, what about you?
It's a comedy?
No, it's not. It's actually a dramatic horror movie.
Oh, okay. I'm going to go with
69. The answer, 77 on Rotten Tomatoes. Alan, you get that one.
Huh.
Yeah.
Has anybody seen that?
The second one? Yeah.
Take Again?
I can't remember. I watched them all when I was younger, but they all kind of blended together to me.
So what did the third one get?
I did not look that one up. 33.5 or 33.3. But don't look anything up, anybody. Mike, you get who went first in that last one there? That was Alan, right?
I think Aaron.
I think I did.
Naked Gun. Okay, so Mike, we're back to you to go first. Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Ooh. Oh, 86.
Alan, what about you?
I don't know. 75.
And Aaron?
90.
The answer, 77% on Rotten Tomatoes. Alan, you get that score.
Yeah. I kind of remembered it wasn't really well reviewed when it came out, right?
I can't recall, but I enjoyed it. Yeah.
Because they didn't like Cape Catshaw. I don't know. I just don't know. I just know that it was like one of the least rated ones before Crystal Skull. So I remember it was lower.
The last couple here. Alan, you get to go first. Hot Fuzz, second in the Cornetto trilogy.
I'm going to say 88.
88 miles per hour. Aaron, what about you?
90.
90. And Mike?
91.
91.
I'll go over.
The answer, 91 on the dot. Mike, you get that one.
Good job.
And the last one here, Aaron, you get to go, or Alan, you get to go first.
Oh.
For a few dollars more. Did you go first in the last one?
I went first for Hot Fuzz.
You did? Okay, then Aaron, you, for a few dollars more.
Hmm.
This is also a comedy.
It's pretty funny. I got that scene where they're shooting their hats. 97.
97. Mike, for a few dollars more. Clint Eastwood.
Oh. I'll go under. 96.
96. Decreasing. Alan, what about you?
I'll keep going down. 90.
90. The answer, 92. Alan, you are the closest two away.
Did Mike win?
No, you got that point.
I meant like overall.
But yeah, the overall for sequels on a scale of Alan, you won 7 points.
Oh,
Mike,
cool.
4 points. Aaron on the board with 1 point. That was games this week. Congratulations, all.
I mean,
good job, Alan. That's really proud. I'm very proud of you.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Good job, Alan. We're really proud of you.
Oh, thanks, Mother. I appreciate it. Appreciate it, guys.
Of course.
I got to stay humble.
All right. Thanks for that game, Abe.
You're welcome.
Let's move on. Let's get to some of that feedback.
Feedback.
This is where we go with various questions and answers on our Facebook page, facebook.com/podcast. We got a number of questions to listeners. They gave us some answers. Then we got some questions as well. Alan, Mike, feel free to throw in as we go through each of these questions.
First question here. What's your favorite film featuring a cult? Philip Hurd has Apocalypto. Chris Cleland has Midsommar, Kill List, and Mandy. David Maloof has The Wicker Man, 1973, and the unintentionally campy 2006 versions. Fight Club, unexpectedly prescient and prophetic. The Omega Man, We Are Family. I get Anthony Zerbe with me.
Is Apocalypto a cult? I mean, seems just kind of like religion at that time.
I feel like
right?
They're just, just religious.
It seems like more like way of life.
I guess you could. Religions can be cults sometimes, I guess.
I mean, yeah. I mean, then you would just apply it to every religion at some degree.
Spotlight.
Spotlight? They need
Paranormal
Robbie.
Paranormal 3.
Paranormal 3?
Cult of Chucky.
Yeah.
Of course.
It's right there in the title.
Yeah.
Have you guys seen the comedy Let's Start a Cult?
I have not, but that sounds familiar.
It's only about a year old. It's very funny.
Hmm.
I never saw it. I remember hearing about it. I never got to see it.
It's funny. Yeah.
All right. Next question we have. What Ralph Fiennes performance most surprised you? Mark Hoffmeyer writes, In Bruges. Mm-hmm. Dan Luth writes, I never heard of him until Schindler's List, and he was bone-chilling as a psychotic Nazi in the film, a movie everyone should be watching right now, by the way. And I really think he was surprisingly, if not amazingly great in The Menu, a performance I think should have garnered him an Academy Award nomination. Chris Cleland writes, Rio was Grand Budapest Hotel, as I hadn't seen him in a comedic role, but seeing him as Dr. Kelson is also incredible for surprising for such a juggernaut actor. And having a dabble into horror, The Menu was surprisingly fun. And then Philip Hurd writes, The Dig.
Hmm. I will also echo the Grand Budapest Hotel.
Doolittle.
Doolittle. Okay. We accept all answers on this show.
What's the movie he's the villain? He's like the fence for art thieves with Nick Nolte.
The remake of Baba Fambur?
The Good Thief? Is that
the
what it's called?
The Good Thief, yeah.
Wow.
He has a great line. He says, if you fuck me or if you don't pay me my money, what I do to your face will definitely be cubist.
That's funny.
Because they're all art thieves. Yeah.
I saw that in theaters. I remember that movie. But it's a remake of Bob Le Fambour. I remember that. It's like, is it a Neil Jordan movie, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good pull.
Great.
I think I came out of Conclave convinced that movie was a comedy.
Yes.
And
yeah, they're vaping. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, when they're vaping, it's very, very funny, right? And so I'm really appreciating, and I said this earlier in the recording, but that he's really, really funny actor. In Bruges, of course, the line, you're an inanimate object.
You're an inanimate fucking object. Yeah, in Bruges is the one I would go to just because it's like, it's so intense and yet so funny at the same time. Like,
but he's got a system.
That's why it's like it's a really good performance because it's like
he's doing in Bruges basically what Ben Kingsley is doing in Sexy Beast,
exactly,
which is just a frothing ferocious madman. And but it's also just really funny.
It's so big that it's funny, but also still nuanced, and like there's a code he has and everything. It just works. That said, I put The Menu in that category as well. Like, it's not that I'm like surprised that he can be funny. Like, Grand Budapest is certainly a great example of that. But like, The Menu was a good reminder of like, oh yeah, he can do this like really well. Like, I didn't expect The Menu to be like as funny specifically because of him as I thought it would be. So I do really think that performance is pretty great.
Well, it's not just the performance. It's also knowing that Ralph Fiennes is an actor who likes taking roles like that makes you like Ralph Fiennes even
more. Exactly. Yes, very much so.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Well, the next question here is, who is the worst cinematic leader David Move has? Lieutenant Gorman from Aliens? 38 simulated? Captain Harriman from Star Trek Generations? It won't be installed until Tuesday. Luke Y. Thompson writes, the guy in The Apprentice... The Apprentice is a TV show, but we'll accept it, I suppose.
There's a movie called The Apprentice.
Oh, that too. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, I take that back, Luke. Phil Pert has Denethor in Return of the King and Cornelius Fudge in The Order of the Phoenix. Chris Clinton has Maverick, Daddy Issues and No Regard for Authority, Sky Marshal Denny's and Starship Troopers.
David Schwimmer and Band of Brothers.
David Schwimmer, Band of Brothers, okay.
Yeah, because he's like a bad, usually like the drill sergeant kind of guy. And
he's a terrible DI.
Yeah.
What's the criteria again? Bad leaders?
Worst cinematic leader.
Yeah.
Because I would have put Ralph Fiennes in Schindler's List. No?
Works.
Shouldn't we just go right to the Nazis?
I like that you're on the...
it depends on your qualifying worst.
I'd rank Nazis. Pretty bad.
Pretty bad.
Pretty bad.
I'll accept it.
Room for improvement.
If we're talking clearly like morality.
Room for improvement.
I'm trying to think because I used to have some good ones for this.
Terrible cinematic leaders. I mean, is Jack Nicholson? He's a good president in Mars Attacks, yeah?
Yeah. So we've got two out of three branches of the.
And that ain't bad.
Yeah.
It's a good Jack.
Well, right. Maybe Few Good Men. Jack and Few Good Men.
Did everything he had to do.
Bad leader.
What a dickhead. Yeah.
All right. What's the
He
scary...
can handle the truth, though. He can handle the truth.
Many can't.
So he proclaims.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What's the scariest zombie movie? Dave Malouf writes, personally, for me, it's 28 Weeks Later, which has one of the all-time best openings for a zombie movie, like, ever. Philip Hurt has Train to Busan. Chris Clinton has, I think it has to be my first watch of 28 Days Later. I know people say it's not zombies, but they're zombies. Also, Wreck. Mm. My answers would be the Wreck 1 and 2 movies. I think those are the scariest zombie movies I've ever seen.
Which one?
The Wreck, R-E-C.
The ones that
Spanish found footage films.
What about, like, Army of the Dead?
Sure.
If that's yours, it's yours.
If that's what blows your boat.
It doesn't.
Well,
I always thought the original Dawn of the Dead always scared me as a kid.
Original Dawn of the Dead, there you go.
Because of your fear of malls?
Hate them.
He hates them, and he's glad that they're dying now.
Biker gangs.
Scary zombie movies. Paranorman, because what we learned is what Aaron said in the review. The scariest monster is man.
Mike, any thought on this?
Scariest, not so much. I do remember liking it when the Rage zombie, when that convention shifted. And so when they did Dawn of the Dead remake, they went with Rage zombies, right?
Uh-huh.
So I do think zombies are scarier when they're faster.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Obviously, yeah. But I'm not too sure. I'm a big fan of like The Girl with All the Gifts.
Oh, yeah, that's sure. a good one. Yeah.
I think that's an underrated film. I think Pontypool was underrated, even though it's a zombie film without a single zombie in it.
Mm-hmm.
Have you guys seen this thing that I think just opened recently called We Bury the Dead? No, We Bury the Living? Is that what it's called? The Daisy Ridley?
I didn't see it. No, I had a screener and it expired.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting one. In line with our conversation about Bone Temple, because it's much more concerned with using the zombie apocalypse to explore themes of grief and loss, and it's particularly concerned with characters who encounter zombies, and like some of them are convinced, no, there's more behind the deadness of their eyes, or are they projecting what they want to see in their deceased loved ones, right? And so that's a pretty key theme of that movie, I think, is kind of interesting when you put it in line with Samson.
That Arnold movie, Maggie, is kind of like that as well.
Oh, yeah.
With
yeah.
him and Chloe,
a little bit.
His daughter, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. I don't know that I answered your question, but
Brunton Thwaites, friend of the show, in We Bury the Dead.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Next question.
The next question here is, what are some of your films that involve curing a disease? Luke White Thompson writes Cobra. Jason Hemming has Outbreak, Snowpiercer, and 12 Monkeys come to mind. We have commentaries for some of those. David Loeb has the aforementioned Omega Man, the ruined by CGI I Am Legend, and the good but not great World War Z, which will never get a sequel for apparently blank reasons. Chris Lynn has Contagion. Philip Hurd has 12 Monkeys. Great movies about curing a disease.
Lorenzo's Oil.
Yeah.
Lorenzo's Oil. Wow. I don't think I've ever...
Nick Nolte.
I am on a Nick Nolte run, huh?
Yeah.
Wow. George Miller. Okay.
It's a very good movie.
Yeah. 7.3 on IMDb. What are some of your films about curing a disease? I mean, Contagion is pretty solid. I do like the Jennifer L scene where the wind's just blowing in her hair. She finds a cure.
I always liked Outbreak, but...
Outbreak, yeah. Rene Russo gets pricked by the needle. He's got to find it to save his wife.
You got to figure it out. You got to save that man.
It became personal.
Did they figure it out at the end of the crazies? Like how to? I can't remember.
They just say, "Hey, you be less crazy," and they're like, "All right."
They're like, "All right."
I'll calm down.
See the power of words in speaking your truths.
All right. What's your favorite use of heavy metal in a movie? Yancey Burns writes, what's funny is that heavy metal the movie uses mostly what would be defined as hard rock. Cheap Trick, Blue Oyster Cult, etc. Chris Cleveland writes, gotta be one of my most listened to soundtracks, Judgment Night. Dave Maloof writes, heavy metal, best Gen X soundtrack ever. And Philip Hurd writes, AC/DC in Iron Man. Favorite use of heavy metal in a movie.
Bill and Ted.
Bill and Ted and Their Excellent Adventures. What's the song used in Manhunter at the end where he like raids the house?
The God of Evita.
There you go.
It's really heavy metal.
It's not really rock.
It's hard rock.
The Crow has a number of heavy metal scenes I can appreciate.
I mean, does School of Rock?
I mean, it has a song called "The."
I mean, right now it's Bone Temple, but I'm trying to think if there's anything else because that one was great.
They got Spinal Iron Maiden,
Spinal Tap,
Push It to 11, baby,
Big Bottom,
Big Bottom.
okay, and now a question to the panel here today. David Maloof asks, "Is there one here today, guys?" Question mark. Rank the 28 days, 28 weeks, and years movies from worst to first. Fascinating. 28 years. I think it'd be 28 years later for me. 28 days later. 28 years later, The Bone Temple. And then 28 weeks later. Did I forget any?
It
was four.
Yeah.
I'd probably do years, temple, days, weeks. I really like this new trilogy a lot. And I like 28 days later, but... it looks like dog shit sometimes, and it's hard to watch. But I really like Years and Bone Temple a lot.
It's
tricky. It's tricky because lumping them together, the Bone Temple is the first film in the franchise to directly continue a story as opposed to having a large gap, right? And so that places a necessary emphasis on people more than on like transitions in society. So they're doing very different things.
And again, I'm still like, I want to know what the third one is. Maybe that will retroactively make me think differently about the other two. Because right now I'm just like, well, I love Weeks. I've always loved Weeks.
Yeah, so we're on the same page with Weeks, right? That Weeks, is, Weeks is superior. The best
one. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I like Weeks.
Perfect.
Yeah, I think Weeks is pretty great. Then I guess it'd be Days, and then if only because I just really like the soundtrack a lot. Years, then Bone Temple, but like they're about the same to me, both of those movies, and they're very close behind Days, honestly. So.
See, I feel a little trapped because I started the conversation by saying I think Bone Temple might be the best one. So if I have to stick to that, does that mean? So
you don't have to stick to anything. You can do whatever you want.
No, Bone Temple at the top. I would put Years and Weeks like on a par, basically interchangeable. And then, I mean, one is the one that started it all. One is terrific, but it hasn't dated well. So I would have to rank it last. Yeah.
Okay.
We'll reconvene, you know, in a year or whatever, when the next one comes out, we'll see where we are then.
Or if we get Danny Boyle on the podcast, but we'll ask him.
D-Boys?
Yeah.
He's a Chicago guy. D-Boys.
He's a Chicago. His movies make much more sense now. He's a Chicago boy.
So that's feedback.
That was feedback for everybody.
Feedback.
And that's going to do it for this week's episode about Now, Theron, and Abe. You can find everything I do on my personal Substack page at codazeek.substack.com. I write for Wheel of Entertainment. Movie reviews can be found there. I co-host the award-winning podcast, Two Black Guys Talk Godzilla, with my friend and friend of the show, Terrence Johnson. We talk about the Godzilla films in chronological order. And I'm on all the socials at Aaron's PS4. Abe?
You can find more on my Instagram, abe.moon, and Twitter, blueskyy.com/walrusmoose. Hashtag moon.
Professor Magno, anything you'd like to plug?
Hashtag charity.
Mm-hmm.
Fair enough. Alan Aguilera, anything you'd like to plug?
You can just follow me on Letterboxd. It's the Aldo Rain. Rain is RAYNE. And you can judge my lists and my viewing.
I do like judging lists since I make so many of my own.
I get bored and I'm just like, I'm going to make a list of my favorite Nick Cage movies.
Yeah, I make lists. They're fun.
Yeah, it's exciting.
All right. Well, you can find all the other episodes about Now, Theron, and Abe on iTunes, Audioboom, Spotify, and Stitcher.
SoundCloud, Podomatic, and Nation should be LOD.
Feel free to email us at outnowpodcast@gmail.com.
Check out our Facebook page and our Blue Sky at @outnowpodcast.
And Twitter and Instagram at @outnow_podcast. Mike, Alan, thank you very much for joining us this week.
Thank you both.
Good to see you.
This has been a lot of fun. I think we had a pretty good conversation about everything. Next week, Mercy comes out. Who we are.
Mercy. Got
Mercy. Yeah. You know, like in that song, Pretty Woman? Mercy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, that's going to do it for this week's episode. So until next time, so long.
And goodbye.
Bye.
Just like that river twisting through the dusty